next year before you can actually get the cash to end.
We would start construction next spring.
And then, so therefore, you're really going to require the legislature to cough up another $20 million there, right?
Over time, yes, sir.
Well, in order to finish the building, I mean.
That's right, over time, I would say that we'd probably ask for about $10 million next year, $10 million year after to finish.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there any further questions?
Yeah.
I'd like, Representative Bedsworth?
In keeping these court facilities together, do you feel that your criminal facilities and your civil facilities need to be adjacent also?
We think they all have to be together, Representative Bedsworth, because the judges transfer between criminal and civil cases. Number of lawyers handle civil and criminal cases. Jurors are pulled in for civil and criminal cases in the same pool. And so we keep them together for the convenience of the police, the public, jurors, attorneys.
To you, it doesn't really make any difference then. This should all be together?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Meekins and Representative Rogers, for working on the bond. The chair will entertain a motion to move out Senate Bill 42, Senate Bill 205, Senate Bill 365, Senate Bill 876, Senate Bill 887, with individual recommendations on these following bills. Representative Cotton.
Mr. Chairman, I move on 887 that we change on line 4, change Anchorage to Sutton.
Is there any objection?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Meekins.
I object to being that specific. Is that, I mean, maybe, you know, you were talking about Matt Valley before. Or 50 miles in Anchorage or something.
Mr.
Chairman.
Representative Cotton, you still have the floor.
I'm open for suggestion there, but I think I want to be more specific than Anchorage. If you're going to put it in Anchorage, that's what you're saying. You're going to put it in Anchorage. Now, if you're saying it's not going to go in Anchorage, well, that's, I think we've got to change it.
Representative Meekins, we should also listen to the representative from that particular district. What is your wish, Representative Cotton?
I think either Sutton or Matsu area is more satisfied. How about Matsu area with that?
Would you move the
I'd move the correction on page 2, line 4, delete Anchorage, insert Matt and Mr. Valley. Mm-hmm.
Is there any objection? Amendment. Chair will entertain the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we report out SB 42 with individual recommendations.
Is there any objection? 42 is moved out.
Chairman, I move that we report out Senate Bill 205 with individual recommendation.
Any objection? 205 is moved out.
Chairman, I move that we report out Senate Bill 365 with individual recommendation.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 365 is moved out of committee.
Chairman, I move that we report out Senate Bill 876 with individual recommendation.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 876 is moved out of committee.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we report out Senate Bill 887 with individual recommendation.
Mr. Chairman?
Is there any objection?
I'd like to have the letter of intent voted on.
Okay, separate. Is there any objection to moving out Senate Bill 887?
Mr. Chairman, I move the Finance Committee attach a letter of intent, the letter of intent that I've recommended to you in my memo of May 14th, which should be included in the package. It just involves the fact that these facilities in Nome and Bethel are now going to be regional multi-purpose facilities, and that was our intent. Without that, they might just have grandiose jails there, and they wouldn't be regional correctional facilities. There's a difference.
Is there a motion to move the letter of intent, Representative Chepoff?
Same bill, but a different subject matter. We moved on as amended. We have amended the 887, did we not?
Yes,
right.
We did.
Yes, as amended.
Yes, correct. As amended. Thank you, Representative Chepoff.
I move the letter of intent.
Is there any objection to moving the letter of intent? That's in your packet? None. The letter of intent will follow. That takes care of the bond issues. The next bill we're going to take up is Senate Bill 212, the Alaska Railroad. This is sponsored by Senator Dankworth. It's established the Alaska Railroad Authority. The House Transportation Committee has offered several amendments which are contained in your bill file. the Department of Transportation indicate that at this point there is no no fiscal impact. We have here to testify on Senate Bill 212.
Two people. We have Mark Hickey with DOTPF. Is he here to testify on this one?
Which bill are we dealing with?
212, the Alaska Railroad.
Well, there's two in here. Just move on. Does that mean anything?
No. It's the one that
Mark
5-4.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Hickey. I'm staff person with the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities on this issue, and did prepare the fiscal note, and essentially I am here and available to explain or answer questions on it. It has a zero amount at this point. The legislation would not become effective until acceptance of the transfer by the legislature, which would be envisioned next year. So at this time, there is no direct fiscal impact. I'd also note that in terms of the ongoing discussion on transfer, DOT has adequately budgeted for it in its current budget.
Question, Representative Cotton?
You said that the transfer wouldn't take place without specific concerns to the legislature. Is that provided for in this bill?
That's correct. The process in Washington in S-1500 envisions once the bill is enacted in D.C., there would be a six-month period for negotiation of a closing report. And I believe it's section page 47 under section 9, that closing report, specifically lines 6 and 7, require legislative ratification. Once that would occur, that would trigger the state's acceptance of the transfer and the authority, effectiveness, the ability of the governor to make appointments.
Occurs at that time.
The only concern I had was that the growing interest in the United States House that Alaska should pay for the railroad. And I don't know what you people generally use as an assessed valuation figure for the railroad and its property. And the suggestion, I think, the Commerce Committee was that the state should pay at least 75% of the value. What is the value that you normally assign to the railroad's property?
The suggestion, the reference is an amendment that was introduced in the U.S. House Commerce Committee 2 weeks ago, is 75% of net liquidation value, which is a formula methodology currently used in some Conrail legislation for liquidation of Conrail lines. We at this point have not had access to that formula, and I don't know a specific answer. I think quite a bit of that is contingent on how they assess property, real property, in terms of the railroad. In terms of the fixed plant and rail properties, rolling stock locomotives as a surplus or a liquidation value, our estimates show it not to be more than probably $10 to $15 million. So you would have 15% of that, or 75% of that. And then the issue of property is a difficult one, because the connotation of it being liquidated triggers under the Native Claims Act and other legislation the potential for that property not to be part of the arrangement for transfer. It is our understanding, in terms of that amendment being offered in the House, that it, in essence, a strategy ploy by the House, once they get the conference with the Senate. That was the railroad in the House was dealt with as a package of a host of railroad amendments, Safety Act amendments, and other things. And the sense, at least in the Senate side, is that it's not a matter of serious concern to people there. So we don't have a number. We certainly could come up with.
Well, so you say about $15 million for the rolling stock and the actual railroad buildings?
Railroad facilities.
Which means?
In terms of the liquidation value.
Yeah. So like an anchor down Ship Creek, all that property down there?
That it does not include the real property.
No real property.
The real property valuation is tough. The FRA is the last group that's ever done that. In 1979, they did a fair market value assessment of rail properties. and put real property at $180 million in 79. We have not yet done a valuation of the property. We're still trying to ascertain exactly what property they have.
What are they talking about, though? Aren't they talking about the net liquid? When they say that the state ought to pay, they're saying the state ought to pay the net liquidation, or the 75% of the net liquidation value.
The problem, it's difficult to pick up, is that this formulation is used in the case of Conrail, where it's a fairly straightforward situation, as if it were a private railroad, and liquidation of it is not a difficult thing once you get through the numbers. The problem we have is that we have a federally owned railroad that, in the case of the real property of the railroad, it's questionable that would be part of the formula, so that you'd be dealing with the fixed plant, the rolling stock, and effectively, that would be very difficult, I think, to have a transfer occur or a purchase occur on those bases.
Further questions? Thank you very much. We do also have J.P. Tangent of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce that was testified on this bill. Thank you very much, Mr. J.P. Your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is J.P. Tangent. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce and also the Anchorage State Chamber of Commerce. I have provided with Representative Bettisworth, I think, copies of the market version of SB 212, and I take it that they're in the packages which you have in front of you. The Alaska State Chamber of Commerce and the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce have put together a position based on the 212, which we feel is significant. We feel very strongly that the present version of Senate Bill 212, which is passed out of the Senate, has many significant defects, the most significant of which is that it creates a whole new bureaucracy. The state of Alaska should not be in the railroad business. We feel it does not know how to run a railroad, and it certainly does not need a new bureaucracy at this time. What is needed is a vehicle to receive the railroad from the United States government and promptly to put the operation of this transportation system into the hands of well-qualified entrepreneurs who have the capability of and flexibility to run a railroad is a money-making proposition. We have no difficulty with the railroad being the state being the beneficial owner of the railroad, but we see no virtue whatsoever in it being the operator. We have proposed that the trappings of bureaucracy which are in SB 212 be stripped out of the bill. What remains is an entity which can receive the railroad and run it responsive to the same requirements of state law as any common carrier. We would give it the powers and duties of a private business. We have provided you with a marked up version of Senate Bill 212, which contains our recommendations. What is most noticeable about this draft is that we have deleted numerous procedural dictates to the authority as to how it should run its affairs. For instance, on page 6, we have deleted provisions as to what constitutes a quorum and how votes should in proxies should be dealt with and that sort of thing. Let your board of directors set bylaws which dictate how they should conduct their own business. We have deleted provisions dealing with conflicts of interest. The provisions of existing state law are more than adequate to ensure that cheating and stealing are discouraged. We have deleted the requirements that the railroad operate in a fishbowl. There is nothing more inconsistent with profit-making activity than making everything that is done by responsible people the subject matter of repeated justification and explanation. The CYA syndrome is everywhere in government simply because everyone has to be prepared at any time to explain everything to anyone who may happen to ask. I, for one, would prefer to act on the principle that most people are honest. On page 14, we have reviewed the powers proposed to the railroad and urge the three kinds of changes, all relating to the question of whether this is a profit-making enterprise or a bureaucratic empire. The changes are, first, that the power of eminent domain be stricken, second, that the power to establish a new police force is eliminated, and third, that the power to generate regulations which have the power of law, of the force of law, be removed. We have also suggested that the railroad have the express power to lobby for whatever regulations or administrative action it requires, just like any other entity. On page 18, we have stricken the provision for giving the state the ability to go in and mess around with the books of the railroad. An annual audit by an independent CPA should be all that is necessary, as in the case with any other major corporation. We have also urged that the provisions dealing with how the railroad should spend its time and money be stricken. The only direction to the railroad should be, along these lines, should be to do the best possible job of making money through running the railroad. We regard the subsurface and mineral rights on the land, with regard to the subsurface and mineral rights on the land, there's no apparent reason why the railroad should not be free to make the decisions as to how and when these resources should be most profitably exploited. Certainly, we all profit from a railroad which is well-financed and would seem to make little difference if the entity paying the railroad's bills are finding the wherewithal through railroading or mining, so long as the disposition of those assets are efficiently restored to the maintenance of the railroad in the final analysis. The ability of the railroad to issue bonds does not have to be spelled out in this legislation. The railroad should have no better right to tax-exempt bonds than any other business, and the legal requirements should be the same. While we can see that the state legislature should be entitled to be apprised as to general developments of a significant nature, which it seems counterproductive for the legislature and the governor to have the duty to second-guess every decision which involves the major assets of the railroad. Likewise, on page 37 of the bill, we have deleted the power of the governor to jump in and rearrange things on the pretext that the authority is not acting properly. The authority is abusing its dictates. The governor should be restricted to asking a court to provide the way to correct the problem through the appointment of a trustee. With regard to the miscellaneous provisions, we note that S-1500 will address the question of whether employees will be employees of the state. We are informed that the present version of the bill requires the state to set up an equivalent system. There is no need for the railroad to have special treatment concerning political activities any more than any other business or for it to have any special tax status. We believe that the authority can be adequately regulated by the provisions of existing state and federal regulations if it is treated like a private enterprise. While these many points have only been touched upon lightly, what we are arguing for is a fairly substantial shift in the philosophy of this legislation. We have consistently presented our views to the legislature and the public during the preparation of this legislation. Without these changes, we fear a wasteful, inefficient, and expensive boondoggle will be spawned. We do not need such a new bureaucracy. Let us instead be content with taking a viable existing operation and giving it the flexibility to let it grow and prosper. Here as elsewhere, we need not more government, but less. Thank you for your attention, Mr. Chairman, and if I'm answering questions, please decline.
I do have a question of you. You made some statements there. Would you rather see the Alaska Railroad going to private ownership versus the state?
I'm not necessarily sure that I can answer that question directly, but I think that it's very clear that it should go into private operation, a third-party operation, rather than operation by the state.
I see. Well, I was just reading a letter here from the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, and it says that we would like to see it maintained as a unit to ease the early transition into private ownership for control and operation. I just wondered if the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce also supports the language that was submitted by the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce.
Yes, sir. I think that it's fair to say we have. I haven't seen that letter.
Is there any questions of Mr. Grimson, Montgomery, and Potter?
I'd just like to ask you, as a member of the chamber, or any of the chamber members, have you had any indication from the private enterprise indicated an interest? In other words, if the state assumed the ownership and contracted out the operation, that involves a tremendous amount of money. And private enterprise, I think it would be great if there would be an interest in it, but due to the notoriety of this for a couple of years, it would seem that someone would have shown an interest. And I guess my question to you is, has there been any indication from any source to operate such a thing from private funds?
I think I'd have to check with the people that are more closely involved in it than I am. But the impression that I have is that there are at least a couple of companies that
have the capability of getting involved with the operation of the railroad. I'd be happy to submit a specific answer to that later on to you, sir.
Mr. Chairman, if there is any information on it, I would be very interested in that specifically. There are many or several companies in the United States that have the financial capabilities, but whether they have the financial desire, depending upon a financial study. Now, following with that, I assume, has there been a request, as far as you know, for a fiscal operational report to any industry? Private industry, normally, if they were interested, would, for the last 2 years, would be looking into that matter. And I wondered if there's any interest from any specific companies or areas. If there are, I'd like to have that information.
I'll be happy to get the provided information.
Thank you, sir. Representative Cotton and Benson. Question, like, you know, you've done quite a bit of work in the bill, it looks like, and the legislature, as you know, kind of going through its dying throes at the moment. So it's, in my opinion, not very likely that we're going to be able to really get down and consider all of the things you brought up.
So one of the possible results is that the bill doesn't, no bill passes this year. Do you think that that's, which is the worst case as far as you're concerned, the bill as it is?
Clearly, the bill as it is worse than no bill at all. The existing legislation, I think, would result in a tremendous problem.
Do you think it would slow down the efforts in the United States Congress to affect the transfer if the state didn't pass the bill?
House Transportation Committee meeting the other day, and it was my impression that when Commissioner Ward was asked that or a similar question, his answer was that it wasn't necessary. Now, we have people from DOT staff here who can respond to that. It's my impression that that would not hurt the S-1500 passage. On the contrary, I think that it may very well take away some of the opposition to S-1500.
It would take away opposition if this bill didn't pass?
Well, it certainly it would put us in a situation where all of us could focus in on exactly what's going to be in F-1500.
Thank you on that. Just one other quick question. I looked through the powers and duties here, the general powers. I didn't see the one that allowed the authority to create its own police.
I think it's, my recollection is it's power number 27 or something. 29.
Maintaining a security force to enforce state law. The authorities regulate.
Representative Bennett-Wood?
I just wanted, if I may, Mr. Chairman, respond to Representative Montgomery's question. There was considerable effort put into seeking a private entity that might be interested in taking over the Alaska Railroad. It's been going on for over a year. I have a number of letters in my files, and the entity that we're all familiar of is Morrison Knudsen Company, which, much to my surprise, is one of the largest operators of railroads in the world, in that they operate complete systems in emerging countries around the world and portions of railroads in the United States, and are very expertise in this area, and they are not interested in the Alaska Railroad as it currently exists. And the reason being that there is no faith or confidence that the Alaska Railroad is ever going to go beyond where it currently is. And that same interest was expressed, or disinterest was expressed, by everybody that replied to my inquiries as to their interest in the railroad. Alaska, unfortunately, has a long-established history of being opposed to development, expansion, utilization of resources, and so forth, of which anybody knows is absolutely essential to the viable operation of rail transportation. And until there's some indication from the state of Alaska and so forth,
as to development of Alaska's vast resources that could utilize and make a railroad viable entity. I'm afraid we're not going to find much interest in the private sector to take it over.
Thank you. Is there any further questions, Mr. Jacoby? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 212? Is there any amendments?
Yeah, that's got a question. Apparently the Transportation Committee offered amendments, but they weren't incorporated as a committee substitute.
That's correct. One of the things that they did pass the amendment, they were not incorporated into the CS, but they were offered as floor amendments. They will be taken up on the floor. And you should have a packet of five of them.
Mr. Chairman? Along the same questions, and looking at the committee report, it states here, we do pass with attached amendments, and it's signed out that way. So my question would be,
same as I think Representative Cotton's, are the amendments really, even though they're not incorporated, with it being signed out on this House committee report sheet, if that doesn't really make those amendments?
Well, it looks like the report sheet that I got, it was originally that way. They had a CS, but then somebody scratched it out and decided to do pass it with amendments.
Right.
And it's quite a difference because we all know that you have to go through each one of these amendments on the floor. It's quite a bit more difficult and lengthy process.
I've got Representative Sutcliffe here who agrees that I'd like to hear his comments that these were agreed that we're not going to be incorporated into a CS, but we're going to go as floor amendments. Representative Sutcliffe?
I don't remember exactly the way the bill was passed out. It was certainly never our intent for expedient sake or anything, but to have those amendments included in the bill as it came to finance.
It was not.
They were to be included as part of the bill to be passed on to finance. That's news to me.
I'm sorry, I've got Representative Fettesworth first.
Go ahead. And these two gentlemen were members of that committee, and I'd like to hear their comments.
Representative McKeffer
with that comment as a member of the committee.
Representative Fettesworth?
This is the first time I've seen that, and I think I'm going to have some problem with it.
Okay, what's the chairman's determination that these amendments are incorporated or are not incorporated?
Are not incorporated in the CS. The chair rules that these are not incorporated in the CS. We're going to be offered as floor amendments on the floor. Representative Fettesworth.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to expedite things, I would like to see this go to a pre-conference committee and to expedite things rather than have all these amendments hashed over again on the House floor as they were in transportation. I would move that the amendments be incorporated in the bill and be passed out as a finance committee substitute and sent to the floor and with a recommendation that...
Is there any objection? Representative Carney.
I support that motion. I think, Mr. Chairman, even despite your ruling, this already does what Representative Bettisworth's motion does. But it says it's amendments passed transportation committee. It's a standing committee, isn't it?
Yeah. I will object. Whatever. Is there anybody from the public that would like to testify on these amendments? I will remove my objections. The amendments are incorporated into a finance CS.
It's a finance amendment.
Yeah, we got to put a switch. Is there anybody else to testify on 212? What is the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Montgomery.
I move that we report out the committee substitute for Senate Bill 212 transportation as amended in the finance.
For the zero fiscal.
Zero fiscal. No.
Finance.
Yeah. Correct. The
committee. Finance. Is there any objection? Senate Bill 212 is moved on. The next bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 692. Senate Bill 692 is sponsored by the Senate Judiciary Committee. It makes several amendments to the duties of the coroners and the coroner's inquest. A fiscal note that accompanies the bill from the last court system indicates a zero fiscal impact. We have here to testify on this is Art Snowden.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Art Snowden, Administrative Director of the Alaska Court System. I'll try not to take up much of your time on this. I know you have many important things to do. This bill is basically a number of technical amendments to existing statutes. And 12 years ago, this legislature, in its wisdom, following model laws around the country, passed the coroner public administrative statute. These revisions were to clarify the authority of coroner and so on and so forth. But the inquest statutes were never amended to include any reference to this new office that you created 12 years ago. I worked very closely with the Senate Judiciary Committee, with the House Health Committee, and with the House Judiciary Committee in this bill. All the amendments are technical. None of them have any fiscal implication. They were drawn up by a committee of coroners across the state from Anchorage, Fairbanks, Kodiak, Ketchikan, Juneau, and members of my administrative office. We've worked closely with Representative Byrne, who is a pathologist. There are no hidden clinkers in this bill. It's technical amendments to the coroner's statute. I'd be glad to take you through them if you think that's needed.
Representative Costa. Mr. Chairman, I'm surprised to be before you. No, it sounds like we have a real good story. Do you want a motion?
Yes, please.
I move it back.
Is there any objection? Senate Bill 692 is moved out of finance. The next one I'll take up is Senate Bill 719. Senate 19 is sponsored by Senator Stimson. It directs the Department of Education to study the feasibility and benefits and costs of a computer network that would enable schools to use computer communication for instruction and administration. The fiscal note of $50,000 accompanies the bill, which would provide the department with funds to conduct the study. Is anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 719? Sir. Your name for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Paul Berg. I'm a computer-based education specialist for the State Department of Education. And very briefly, I'd just like to convey the State Board of Education's endorsement of the Bill 719.
And to express that this would give us the opportunity to have or develop a plan for networking of microcomputers, educational microcomputers around the state. And there is an information sheet that I believe all of you have, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Montgomery?
Just one question. Was this put in the commissioner's budget to the governor last fall? If not, why not?
I don't believe it was, sir, and I don't, I have no objection to the study, and I well understand it, but it's a very small bill, $50,000 to me, but it would seem it would be something that the commissioner would put in his budget when he took his budget to the governor last fall, and it was encompassed in the budget. So you do not know or do know if it was put in?
I don't have that information.
Any further questions? President Cotton.
$50,000.
It's for a feasibility study to determine, basically to develop a plan for compatibility of networking systems. Schools and districts are right now experimenting with networking, and there's a great concern that incompatible systems will result without
the theory of contract.
Any further questions? What's the pleasure of the group?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we report out SB 719.
For the fiscal note of $50,000?
Correct.
Any objection? Senate Bill 719 is moved out of House Finance. The next bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 817. 817 makes changes in the state's general relief medical program. In light of the state's fiscal constraints, the bill adds two new groups to the list of those eligible for Medicaid: low-income children and low-income pregnant women. These two categories are currently eligible for general relief medical. Senate Bill 817 also makes a number of other things which are detailed in a memorandum contained in your file. There is a proposed House Finance CS which makes one change. This version adds Section 4 addresses the Department of Health and Social Services' ability to contract for provided services. There is a similarity to the language House Finance previously approved in House Bill 357, which relates to adult public assistance.
Here to testify, we have Rod Bennett on it. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Rod Bennett, Director of the Division of Public Assistance in the Department of Health and Social Services. And I won't go back through everything that's in Senate Bill 817, but basically the intent of the bill is to leave the department with greater flexibility to get by with funding levels for 83 between Medicaid and General Relief Medical, given that we can't continue to support a 20 to 30% growth in those programs with 15% general fund increase. And what it will guarantee is that the children under General Relief Medical and the pregnant women, not otherwise coverable by ASCC, will be moved under Medicaid and protected from any changes in the General Relief Medical program. The department doesn't have any problems with the contracting language that's been added in the committee substitute and strongly supports this bill. One final point is that the Medicaid and General Relief Medical budgets need to be appropriated as a single appropriation rather than as separate appropriations in order for the department to have the full effect of Senate Bill 817.
Now, what we're doing here is we're combining the Medicaid and General Relief Medical. Is that correct?
We're combining them as far as budget purposes in a single appropriation. That's correct.
Don't these appropriations work in the operating budget?
Yes, they do.
Well, how come we have a fiscal note here of $9 million that's in our packet?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the fiscal note is to receive and expend additional federal money. No state general fund increases in the bill, just additional federal money.
Expend additional federal funds.
Any further questions? Mr. Chairman, just one on the, which fiscal note are we referring to? I have about three. The latest one is today, May 15, 1982.
The one that shows for fiscal 83, $9 million plus $10 million for Elfro.
What was wrong with the one in March that showed $22 million?
I have that one too. It dropped from 22 million to 9 million.
I don't know the one in March. There have been some changes to this bill.
Well, that'd be quite a change. It's signed,
but I don't
signed by David Keith yet.
Public assistance.
Yeah.
I guess I don't have that one, Mr. Chairman.
Anyway, you're saying that the correct one is
correct one is the one today, which has a $9 million additional federal fund impact, but no state general fund impact.
Allison, do you want to comment on the fiscal note dated March 22, 1918? Do you want to come in with questions?
I think that the fiscal
is there further questions regarding Senate Bill 817 with Mr. Pettit? If not, thank you very much, sir. What's the pleasure of the group?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Montgomery.
I move that report out House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute Senate Bill 817 Finance with a fiscal note showing federal funds of 9185.2.
Is there any objection? None. Senate Bill 817 is moved out of committee. The last bill we have to take up to us is Senate Bill 252. It's sponsored by Senator Katula. It increases the percentage of state participation in grants for water supply, sewage, and solid waste facilities. There is a proposed House Finance Committee substitute which adds a new Section 4 dealing with funds for operation and maintenance of such facilities. The state currently may supplement these costs, and the House budget contains $93,000 for this purpose, and the Senate's $110,000. This is in the operating budget. The total cost of this provision is expected to be $535,000. Should this bill pass, I would make everyone to see that the final budget reflects the increased costs. We had a similar version like this, and I think Representative Duncan's bill earlier that went by for us. This changes from 50% to 70%, whereas I think Representative Duncan's bill went from 50 to 75%. Representative
Where is that bill? That's in Senate rules, the House bills and rules?
I think it's over in Senate side.
Over in Senate side.
Yeah, except they wanted to pass it over earlier, don't you remember?
No, I didn't remember.
Oh, no, I... Damn it, you should have remembered.
No.
Well, you know, this is the...
Sorry.
The problem, of course, is that the water and sewer bond that we just passed, that doesn't put any money into this fund, so that we can change the percentage, but there's no money there.
Exactly.
So we should, I think, if the conference ever ends up on that, we might consider, or reconsider the possibility of putting some money into a fund that, so people that really do go through the regular procedure and apply for these projects or so that, you know, they can be funded when they're ready to be funded and based on merit rather than on politics. I think it makes some sense. Other than that, but I don't have anything else to say.
What's the pleasure of the group? Representative?
I move House Committee Substitute for Committee Substitute for Senate Bill Number 252 Finance. Has to be unanimous consent.
Any objection? Not 252 is moved out. That takes care of the agenda for today. We will meet on 8:30 on Monday morning to consider those three bills that I mentioned on the floor today. There is nothing else to come before finance. House Finance is adjourned until 8:30 Monday.
It's tomorrow off.
Yeah. It's 3 o'clock by my watch.
I missed that.
Order. Let the record show I have a quorum and the members present. The first bill we're going to take up is Senate Bill 693 and Senate Bill 735 as they go together. There is a second proposed House Finance CS for Senate Bill 693. As you may recall, last week the committee adopted a CS which upgraded a district court judge in Valdez to a superior court. These two sections now remain in Section 693. The bill does not reflect the other provision which relate to judicial retention elections. I've moved that and put it into a CS on Senate Bill 735. These sections are now found where I just mentioned. We did have both these bills before us last week. The first one, 693, is placing a judgeship in, upgrading the judgeship in Valdez. The fiscal note for that is 25.2.
Is there any questions? We also had Art Snowden testify on these two bills last week.
Move and ask unanimous consent to report our committee substitute to Senate Bill 693 Finance. Ask unanimous consent.
And the fiscal note?
And the fiscal note.
Any objection? Takes care of that. The next one I just read across was Senate Bill 735. It's the language concerning judicial retention elections. We've also had that before us last week. The fiscal note on for elections is $66,000. We took care of this also.
You said there was a fiscal here.
Yeah. Is there any questions on it?
Move the bill.
There's the move the bill and also the fiscal note. Is there any objection? No objection. Senate Bill 735 has moved out of committee. The last bill we'll take up today is Senate Bill 320. It's sponsored by Senator Stimson. It established in the statute a staff development program for employees of school districts and REAAs. Currently, most districts conduct in-service training programs. This legislation would enable for statewide coordination of the programs as well as provide a mechanism as for long-range planning. A fiscal note in case no cost would be incurred during the 83 as the Department of Education would be developing regulations and assessing the development of the training program. Cost would then be included in the department's FY84 budget. Is there anybody here to testify on Senate Bill 320?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Cooksey with NEA Alaska. And speaking briefly to it, we sure support the concept and would encourage you to support this kind of program. As indicated, some of the districts are doing this kind of thing, and we feel that this is an opportunity to encourage all the districts to move on into it, to have longer range plans. And we too feel there should not be a cost the first year in that primarily they would be trying to decide what they want to do, then making application for funds. You folks then could determine whether or not to fund or to what extent to fund. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I have one question. Number one, this can be accomplished without a law. It doesn't require a law, nothing about it. And the way it's written here, of course, it's a law, and then they're not going to implement it this next fiscal year. There's nothing presently that precludes the, I see that the Commissioner of Education approves of the philosophy. There's nothing in the world wrong with him in including that in his budget. It doesn't take a law to do this. Just takes, he can put it in as a matter of budget. I don't understand why they want a law for it.
It maybe in my mind, maybe this is an encouragement for people to look at that kind of thing and to make a greater effort in this on this front.
I think the in-service training, I understand the value of it. And most, as you said, most districts do it anyway. But why make a law to do in-service training? That's what you can do now, which an individual district can do it on their own. The State Department of Education can do it. All they've got to do is put bucks in. But it does show $500,000 for fiscal 84. And by the fact that you pass a law, they don't... It seems to me it's a real weak thrust, Bob. The idea is fine, but it's a very weak thrust. If you're going to just study it for a year for nothing, a year in advance, hell, why don't they just put it in the budget if they want? I think it's a bunch of garbage.
I think I might respond in that I think initially we indicated that it shall be done. And of course, we find that again, the specific mandate isn't there because it would allow the legislature to determine how much money to put in it. The $500,000 fiscal note for the second year is a wild guess. Neither you nor I could determine if that's even appropriate. I think that's the reason they decided to back off to give it a year for the people to decide what they want, make application. Then you folks can decide how much money is available.
Bob, when they have that prerogative anyway. You know, the legislature's going to have the prerogative and approve the amount of the budget. If there's nothing, as I said, to preclude Commissioner Lind going before the governor in the fall and putting it in the budget. No. And then have a plan. I just don't see the necessity of a law. It says here, a city, a borough, an REA may establish blah, blah, blah. Hell, they don't need that law. That's in effect now. There's not one damn thing. I don't see why we clutter up our books with a law that's not necessary. I can't see the necessity. I don't see anything in there that any of the school districts can't do right now. Is there one thing in there now that they can't do?
Mr. Chairman, I would have to agree that this law does not require them to do it. And I would also have to agree that those districts could be doing some of this stuff now if they would. Probably, in my mind, the key difference being that this is a signal to them that this is a good idea. Now, if you folks feel you could go with that, would appreciate it. I would have to agree with Joe that they could be doing some of this stuff now. I'm not sure that the department would be that cooperative. And there is a key difference in it, in that the department would be approving these programs prior to the money request coming to you.
Bob, they've already approved it with the letter. They said, hell, it's a good idea. All you got to do is have the commissioner go to the governor when he builds his budget and put X number of dollars in there, and the districts want it, they can have it. I don't disagree with the concept. I just think it's foolishness.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. If I could answer other questions, we'd be happy to.
Representative Carney?
Mr. Chairman, do we have to move this bill today?
No, we don't have to move this bill today.
It seems to me, Mr. Chairman, that even though it is strictly permission, that we should know before we pass it what the cost is going to be next year. And it seems to me that can be accomplished by doing whatever study they were going to do with it. So we know this next year what the cost will be before we pass the bill.
Are you requesting that the bill be held over?
Just a suggestion.
Okay. Representative Carney, you and Montgomery are in effect assigned to Senate Bill 320. 320 is into the subcommittee of Carney and Montgomery. That taking care of this morning's business and House Finance. House Finance is adjourned.
House Finance, please come to order. Let the record show we have a quorum, show which members are present. This is Be Nice to State Employee Day. What bill are you here for today? Senate Bill 89. We'll take your bill of first one. Senate Bill 89 is originally sponsored by Senator Parr. It amends the Child Protection Law. It adds sexual abuse as one of the conditions under which the Department of Health may assume emergency custody. It also amends the Child Protection Report, the statute, to require school administrators and individuals involved in daycare and foster care to report child abuse and neglect if they become aware of it. It also permits the taking of photographs of the injuries of the child and, if medical indicated, of x-rays. It also provides a penalty for failure to report. The House Judiciary Committee adopted a CS which makes several changes to the Senate version. It deletes reference of sexual exploitation as a basis for the Department of to assume emergency custody. It also deletes the penalty for failure to report. It also details the duties of public authority to investigate and reviewing reports of child abuse or neglect. A fiscal note from the Department of Family and Youth Services indicates zero fiscal note. Your name, sir?
I'm John Pugh from the Division of Family and Youth Services. The Senate Bill 89 has a history of having been introduced in the last session of the legislature by Representative Parr at that time, and then again this time by Senator Parr during this session of the legislature. The department has supported this type of legislation in the last session and again in this session. The most important aspect of the legislation, however, that we were supporting was the addition of the school administrative staff members, as well as the individuals involved in daycare and foster care in the reporting of child abuse and neglect. And this has been removed in the committee substitute that is before you from the House Judiciary. The addition of these members, as proposed by Senator Parr, of these individuals to reporting, the department feels is very important. These individuals in their day-to-day work constantly involved in discovering cases of child abuse and neglect, and if they're not mandated to report, oftentimes these kinds of cases will basically slip through the cracks. So we would ask this committee to at least consider the addition back in of the reporting of school administrative staff members as well as the individuals involved in daycare and foster care. The second thing that was not mentioned in the judiciary report, which is a change in the substitute from the Judiciary Committee versus the actual bill that came over from the Senate, was on line 21 of the bill, 21 and 22. There's a page 1 of the bill, line 21 and 22. The bill indicates that it says through physical abuse or neglect or sexual abuse requiring the attention of a practitioner of the healing arts, in Senate Bill 89 coming over from the Senate, requiring the attention of a practitioner of the healing arts was removed, because many times in cases where young children, particularly in the area of sexual abuse, will not report the sexual abuse immediately, but will have the sexual abuse may have occurred 6 months ago, even sometimes as much as a year ago, and yet, in fact, they do not need medical attention, but they do need to be protected from further sexual or physical abuse. And so the Senate bill did remove that requirement of attention of practitioner of healing arts. And we would again recommend that the committee look at going back to the original language as came over from the Senate.
What's the difference between sexual abuse and sexual exploitation?
Sexual exploitation is under the criminal statute, is where a parent or another adult actually utilizes a child in the sense of child pornography or other types of sexual activities. And it is a crime under Alaska statutes, but this would just make clear that the agency also can be involved in protecting the child, removing them from the parent, that not only the parent would be charged with the crime, but that the protection could come from the child from the department.
Well, John, what was the rationale for taking, I think you made some real good points there. I can't understand why they'd want to take out the business about the administrative staff members having to report as well. Also, the those businesses are requiring the attention of a doctor. Just because they don't need a doctor doesn't mean that there hasn't been some abuse there. I don't understand what the rationale was.
I was not at the committee hearing. The hearing was held. We did not know when the hearing was at that time, and I was not there. We were not at that hearing when it was removed. I did testify in judiciary prior to the committee substitute coming out in support of the bill as it had come before the House judiciary.
When was this reported out yesterday?
I think it was reported out. We got the bill yesterday. It may have been reported out the day before, but we got the bill yesterday.
Would you read for the record the judiciary report, please? How it came out of the committee.
Yes. Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. Did Hess have the bill first and then
yes,
the judiciary?
Yes, they did, and they reported it out.
Can we ask the Hess first and then the judiciary?
Please.
Yeah, the Hess report, Cato, Malone, Martin,
Byrne.
And Bernstein and Dupin.
On the Senate version, they didn't offer a committee substitute.
No, Hess did. And judiciary recommended House Judiciary CS and O'Connell plan do pass if not amended. Anderson, Novak, Buchholz do pass if amended. Phillips do pass if amended. Barnes, Novak.
Thank you very much, Mr. Representative Carney.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, why do we have this bill? It's just about zero.
Would you like to answer for the department?
The fiscal note is zero. We don't know why it was referred to the Finance Committee. It still is zero. There has been no change with the next committee.
Were there questions?
I have one. Representative Cuddy?
Short question. It seems to me there should be a fiscal note if there are going to be more children taken in and more attention given to them and more time, more facilities necessary.
I would say that in the fact of more children taken in, I don't think that necessarily is true, but this does, our legal attorneys have indicated that this does give the department more protection. Right at the moment, more often than not, the attorney generals will rule that we can take a child under emergency custody if in fact they've been sexually abused or sexually exploited. The attorneys have indicated that if the child does not need immediate medical attention, that under 4710, which is the statute which requires the department to act in emergency situations, that we can take custody, but the Department of Law has felt strongly that these things need to be cleared up in the statute because there's some question before the court, particularly, for example, taking emergency custody of sexually abused children, as well as the issue of the requiring medical attention, that there are inconsistencies in the law that do need to be cleared up. There are a couple of other major changes that came out of judiciary, too, that if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, to speak to.
You have another question?
No, I have the same question. Perhaps I wasn't listening, but I didn't hear your answer to my question.
My answer is I don't think that we do not think that there will be that significantly larger number of children, but in fact, from a legal perspective, this will be more of a protection. That in cases where there's a challenge from a defense attorney on these issues, these legal issues, for example, that the child does not require medical attention, that we will in fact, would in fact be protected under the law if this was removed. And at the moment, even though we may be taking them, there's a challenge in the law in the sense that the law is stricter
you're
the way
you're
it's designed.
Yes. And this just gives you permission to do something you've been doing all along. So
it strengthens our argument for it, definitely.
Okay, thank you.
And there's another large section that was added by the judiciary, and that starts basically on duties of public authorities in 4717025.
What page is the
bill? That is on page 2, line set, starts in line 17. And this is something that in judiciary testimony, the Department of Law, which I don't think is here this morning, asked to have added to this bill. But as it came out of the Department of Law, the issue was a law enforcement agency shall immediately notify the department of the receipt of a report of harm to a child from abuse, not abuse or neglect. And the reason was the Department of Law feels that there are
serious abuse cases, both physical abuse and sexual abuse, which have criminal elements to them, particularly in sexual abuse, where there needs to be filing of criminal charges. But the issue of neglect never arose in that testimony, and I think that neglect cases would rarely, I mean, very, very rarely would ever be charged in criminal charges. So I think in this section that the or neglect definitely should be removed, because it's not appropriate for those to be referred to the Department of Law at all. If in fact this is a legislative decision to go in this direction for referral to the Department of Law, I don't think the neglect cases should be. And that or neglect appears on line 19, line 23, line 25, line 2 of page 3, and then line 5 and 8 of page 3. And I think those issues, I don't think that the legislature, I mean, certainly I think that there's a real question of why those should be reported to the law enforcement, I mean, to the Attorney General's office in black cases. Finally, I guess the other thing that was removed in the report indicated was the penalty. Most states, majority of states, do have penalties for not reporting. And this was something that had been suggested in the Senate Bill 89 coming over from the Senate. It was confirmed by the Hess Committee here in the House that there be a penalty. There had been some debate about whether it should be a misdemeanor or whether it should be some civil penalty. But some penalty is in almost every other state statute. And I think, well, the Department would recommend that the penalty be placed back into the bill as originally coming over from Senate Bill 89.
Representative Montgomery. Yeah, question.
Yes. You may have answered this and I missed it, but in the Senate bill at the top of page 2, it refers to school teachers and school administrators.
Right.
Was that omitted in the second one?
Yes. Correct.
Why? Again, I missed
it. I have no idea, Representative Montgomery.
Well, this one, then this bill, the
House Judiciary
Subcommittee, would that lessen the responsibility of teachers then?
It wouldn't lessen the responsibility of teachers, but it does not add the administrators. And the problem at the moment has been oftentimes teachers, the policy in school districts is teachers report to administrators, and sometimes administrators then have not reported it on for various reasons. And this makes it clear that the responsibility, if the teacher discovers and reports to the administrator, then the administrator has to pass that on under the statute.
Did you attend both subcommittees?
I attended at Hess, and then the first hearing. There was two hearings on this in Judiciary before this committee substitute came out. I attended both of those and testified in both of them, but I did not attend when this was passed out.
What is your recommendation on this bill, the Judiciary? Other than that, you said you would recommend changing the.
My recommendation would be to go back to the Hess, committee bill, or. If in fact we want to add 4717,
I think what you'd like to do is go back to the rule, the one that the original version came out of the Senate, and including on it is add in section 4717.025, paragraphs 7, line 17 through all the way to the next page of page 3 up to 5, and delete the words or neglect. And if I read it correctly, that's your recommendation.
Correct.
Representative Cotton?
One thing we could do here, without maybe getting anybody mad at us, would be to just give a recommendation to the committee that we accept the bill, and then have somebody propose the amendment that would add the public authorities. And we could either recommend that as finance committee substitute an amendment, or have somebody offer the amendment to the floor.
I'd like to go out as a finance committee substitute.
I'd move that we begin with the bill that passed the Senate and add the section 7 of the House Judiciary Committee substitute, removing the words or neglect on lines 19, 23, 25. That's on page 2 and on page 3, lines 2, lines 4 and 5, and line 8. And have that incorporated into the Finance Committee substitute for the bill 89.
And that's for unanimous consent?
Yes.
Any objection? Senate Bill 89 is accepted. Is there anybody else to testify on it before I move on? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next bill we're going to take up is Senate Bill 167,
sponsored by Senator Kelly revises a number of sections of statutes which deal with state election campaigns, regulation of lobbying and public offices and employees. Some of these changes include requiring candidates to report only those expenditures and contributions which exceed $250 instead of $100 and increasing the contribution limit from $1,000 to $2,000.
It also makes a number of changes in reporting requirements. The House State Affairs Committee adopted a CS which rewrites the Senate version, abolishes APOC, and transfers responsibilities for regulations of conflict of interest and lobbying to the Commissioner of Administration. Other APOC responsibility would be transferred to the Director of Elections. The House Judiciary also adopted a CS which makes technical corrections for the State Affairs version. The Senate version has no fiscal impact. Fiscal notes from the House State Affairs version indicates the Division of Elections would need $155,600 for FY83, while the Department of Administration would need $173,600. Is there anyone here that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 167? Ma'am? Your name for the record, please.
My name is Theda Pittman. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Offices Commission. The handout is an overview of some general comments on the bill and does include a list of the amendments to campaign disclosure, which the Commission has been working on for 2 years now. The Alaska Public Offices Commission opposes the provisions of both of the House Committee substitutes for Senate Bill 167, which abolished the Commission. And as you indicated, Representative Adams, assign responsibility for campaign disclosure to the Director of Elections and the responsibility for conflict of interest and regulation of lobbying laws to the Commissioner of Administration. The Commission believes that the net effect of such a transfer will be to dilute the effectiveness of the disclosure laws by assigning them to agencies with substantial workloads which are materially different from the duties of a disclosure agency. The Commission, as organized presently, is committed to the process of disclosure, including both sides of assisting those who are required to file, as well as providing public access to the information on file. The suggestion was made by the people who originated this particular plan to abolish the Commission that to do so would make life more efficient for state candidates and provide a cost savings to the state. That statement overlooks a couple of factors, one of which is that state candidates would still have to deal with two different entities since they're required to file state conflict of interest forms at the time of becoming a candidate. It also minimizes or overlooks the simple fact that budget reductions will bring reduced service in terms of public accessibility to the information and in the assistance which is available to those subject to the laws. The committee substitute for Senate Bill 167, as approved by the Senate, contains numerous constructive amendments to the campaign disclosure law. It doesn't deal with the conflict of interest law or regulation of lobbying at all. A substantial number of the campaign disclosure amendments were worked on in 1981, with additional items developed and advocated by the Commission this year. The list, which is attached to the handout, summarizes those amendments, and the Commission would ask for adoption of the committee substitute for Senate Bill 167 rules amended. The reason for that request is because the Commission believes that an action like that holds the best hope for seeing that the constructive amendments to campaign disclosure, which are on the attached list, are actually accomplished this year. In addition to the rundown of what's in the version of the bill as it passed the Senate, the final page of the handout is a memorandum from Senator Kelly, which indicates a typographical error in the Senate version of the bill that would need to be corrected. I think the additional things I'd like to just mention are that it's somewhat ironical
when you look at the list of amendments to campaign disclosure, that's a package of some items which are housekeeping and fine-tuning, some items which were developed as a result of the effort to try to reduce the burden of disclosure without gutting its impact or its effect. And it was the commission that was the genesis for that, for those ideas. The plan to abolish the commission doesn't have the support. I've heard Patty Ann testify to the Division of Elections. It's not thrilled with the idea of trying to cope with campaign disclosure requirements. The Department of Administration people could speak for themselves. The governor was very clear when he reviewed the first work of the budget about what he thought about, in effect, abolishing the commission by reducing its budget. The League of Women Voters is on record with letters, I believe, to the House talking about the importance of an independent citizen commission.
I don't think, in terms of the critics and the comments I've heard by those who support the House versions of the bill, that we're really talking about money. It's an interesting question. It's an interesting discussion, of course. There's a person who I won't name who two or three years ago was real fond of saying, well, the APOC spent more money than all the candidates put together. Of course, the election that he was talking about was a municipal election year in which there were no major controversial municipal elections. And the vast amount of money he was talking about was less than $400,000. I used to think that maybe I'd run into him so that I could say, sure, if you want to base how much money the disclosure agency should have to administer the disclosure laws on the amount of money that are on those reports, the commission would be happy to discuss having a percentage of what the lobbyists should spend each year, because that year the lobbyists spent nearly $2 million, and the commission would have had a lot of money to work with if that had been the case. The workload is substantial, and the reference that I made to the fact that if you simply look at it in terms of reducing the budget, you're going to look at it in terms of reducing the assistance people get. The assistance that people get falls into the categories of people who have to comply and people who don't have to comply, because we also get the inquiries from folks who say, do I have to do this? If so, if I accept the position subject to the conflict of interest law, what will I have to fill out? A lot of that kind of activity. But in terms of the volume of material, the numbers of people, and the kinds of things that the three existing disclosure laws deal with, the population of municipal candidates is real steady. That's about 350. The size of municipal campaigns is not real steady, because this last year it was about $1.4 million, thanks to an Anchorage mayoral race. The number of political groups ranges from 150 to maybe 300. I think there will be about 300 this year in the state election. And that will include some groups that are going to be very active on some ballot propositions in November. In 1980, there were about 175 state candidates, and that was when there were only 50 legislative seats left. And those state candidates spent about $2 million. I don't know what's going to be spent this year when there are 58 seats left, and reapportionment has caused people to file who otherwise might have waited another year or two. At the end of 1981, the state candidates, including the early starters in the gubernatorial race and some of the legislative candidates, filed reports worth $1 million. It's quite possible that we will have a $10 million election this year in the state when you add up all of those various things. Then there's the lobbying population. There were 300 registered lobbyists last year, with 260 employees. The conflict of interest population is something over 600 state conflict of interest forms and about 1,800 municipal forms coming from 100 communities. And as I said, in addition to those people who are required to file, there are the people who aren't required to file but need information to confirm that fact for them. So I don't think that the commission's budget request is it at all an outrageous amount of money, given the numbers of people and the complexity of the issues at hand. I don't really think, though, that we're arguing about a $600,000 budget request. It has been interesting to talk about changes in the campaign disclosure law, because there's a kind of duality between, on the one hand, there will be criticisms that the commission isn't tough enough, there haven't been enough people thrown in jail, and on the other hand, there will be people are being harassed and intimidated. People aren't being harassed for the sake of harassment. The commission does remind people when they're overdue with requirements to file certain information. It is intimidating, perhaps, to know that one is in the position where the failure to do something has a potential criminal violation. And again, people have said, and I think in all sincerity have said, well, I don't want to be hauled up on criminal charges for an innocent mistake. It is, in fact, a substantial portion of the commission's responsibility to take steps to review matters to make sure that people aren't hauled up on criminal charges for an innocent mistake. And frankly, I think they do that quite well. The final thing, and one of the other comments that I heard by one of the people who wants to abolish the commission was that the commission tries things in the press. Well, you're all aware that the commission has no control over what the press considers newsworthy. And it is true that when a potential violation is being investigated, that that's considered newsworthy. When 95% of the people who file reports file them on time and file them with no major errors or omissions, that isn't considered as newsworthy. There's not much the commission can do about that. I do think that it's unfortunate that the people who comply and comply on time, comply willingly if not happily, don't get more credit for doing that. Because by and large, 99% of the people that we deal with are people who are aware that the law exists, know that it applies to them, and simply want to know what they have to do in order to be in compliance, want to double check something, that sort of thing. That part of it gives one a substantially good feeling about the fact that what's on file is accurate. It is undeniably true, however, that disclosure is not convenient. There's no way around that. The commission is well aware of that and has tried to structure amendments that will reduce excessive burdens. I think they will continue to look for ways to do that in ways that they can continue to call constructive without betting the effect of disclosure. I think that one of the best things that could happen would be if people got credit for complying with the disclosure laws, or in fact took more pride in the fact that they did so and said, it's there on the record. If you have questions, you can look at it. I think that's one of the best things that could happen. I think the commission will continue to encourage people to be aware that that's what disclosure is really about. And would ask, again, that you adopt the Senate version of the bill.
Thank you. Is there any questions, Representative Cotton?
Do you think it's wise to make a lot of major changes to a campaign laws right before an election? Do you think it would be better to have an effective date to take place after the upcoming election? For a couple of areas here, an example, the current law allows a $1,000 contribution and a required reporting above $100, and this was proposed to raise that to $250 and raise the limit to $2,000. Also, there's another area here that I'm not sure about. That, 12 and 13.
Do you have
the bill for me?
Mm-hmm. Which version?
I'm talking about the Senate bill.
Okay.
If a successful candidate for state of municipal elected office is convicted of a misdemeanor described in AS 1513 3 or 6, the election of that candidate shall be declared void. And that includes refusing to make a reasonably complete statement or report required made under this chapter. What happens if I refuse to make a reasonably complete statement in the judgment of the Superior Court right now? Can my election be voided?
Not by the Superior Court, but by the Supreme Court.
You're making it easier to kick a candidate out in this new bill.
To
remove a person after they've been elected, you can have the election void easier under this bill.
you look at, okay, on page 12, section 27, where it substitutes superior for Supreme Court.
Yes.
Okay, that's what's in the law at present.
The Supreme Court.
And the Supreme Court asked for the change to Superior Court because the Supreme Court is not a trial body. What they did in the one case, the Marshall case, was they had to appoint a special master to review the facts.
The Marshall case?
Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the Marshall case.
Joe Marshall was a municipal candidate in Fairbanks who did not file any information before the election, did have campaign contributions and expenditures, and the commission, after a hearing, petitioned the Supreme Court to review that matter. And the Supreme Court did declare Mr. Marshall's election void. Subsequently, both the Assembly and the City Council of Fairbanks appointed him to fill the vacancy which he had created. The Supreme Court wanted it to go back to the Superior Court, but as the first place, because the Superior Court would be the one that would do the fact-finding trial.
Okay. What about my first question here about, do you think it's a good idea to do that right before the election to raise the limits which the politicians are allowed to take?
Can I just finish one other point about that? This section, section 27, is the one that Senator Kelly's memo refers to that needs to come out because it was subsequently replaced on the floor of the Senate by section 29 on page 12. And that version...
So if you're taking 27 out, which means it doesn't go to the Superior Court.
No.
And
no.
29...
29 requires that the person be convicted first. So it would...
That would automatically put it to the Superior Court.
Mm-hmm.
I see.
But it requires conviction. 27 doesn't require conviction of a misdemeanor.
So you repealed 120B then?
The Senate did, yeah.
That's the 15, 13, 120B, yeah, repealed, yeah, I see.
What happens in section 29 is that the person has to be tried and convicted of a misdemeanor, and then whether or not the person is removed from office is basically up to the body to the election. In terms of whether or not it's wise to change such things in an election year, the commission was hopeful that perhaps changes could have been accomplished early in this session. The devil in the deep blue sea of the matter is that in an off year, it's been very hard to get anybody interested in an APOC bill at all. And so, hence the effort to try to get some changes made this year. I think that an effective date that's later is perhaps fairer. I think that an early effective date is most disruptive to the people who haven't run for office before and aren't familiar with the rules.
There's an immediate effective date on the
whole bill. Uh-huh. I understand that. If you already know what the rules are and then someone says, well, change it to reporting names over 250. That's a process which, that's not going to make much difference in terms of the records now are being kept so that people can identify when a contributor passes the $100 mark. The same records will identify when a contributor passes the $250 mark.
I noticed there's kind of a conflict when you say that over 250 there has to be a disclosure, but over 100 you have to give the guy a receipt. But you can say that for under 50 they don't have to give a receipt. It seems like that if you're going to report, if you got to give a receipt, that may be the record. So you really still recording over $100.
The receipt business has to do with cash contributions. At the moment, the statute says that if somebody offers you a campaign contribution of more than $100 in cash, you have to refuse it.
That's kind of
awesome. Mm-hmm. The commission, frankly, isn't sure that that's reasonable. There are arguments about that. I mean, there are arguments about, obviously, cash isn't traceable. But
the requirement to add a repeating requirement was simply to try to support some kind of record for the cash contribution. Whether or not you make a receipt for a check, you deposit a check into a bank account, the bank can reconstruct for you where that check came from.
Is there any further questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 167? No? Your name for the record, please.
I'm Patty Ann Polly, Director of Elections. I just would like to state very briefly that the Division of Elections would certainly much prefer to see the Senate version of the bill passed. The Division of Elections feels at this point that we have enough responsibilities to accomplish in terms of the 1982, what with reapportionment and a new election code to be implemented, that we have concerns about implementing the House versions of these bills prior to the 1982 election.
Any questions? Division of Elections. Thank you, Matt.
I am not going to state my position on APOC. As you know, I thought $100,000 was more than sufficient for them to operate their little gang there. What is the pleasure of the body? You have before you three different CSs. You have a CS that came out of rules, out of the Senate. You had a CS that came out of Judiciary and also one out of the House State Affairs. The chair at this time will entertain a motion.
You won't be good.
If you desire, Representative Monica.
Could I ask Kirk to read the preview?
What's the pleasure of the body?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Montgomery.
I move we report out the House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 167, State Affairs. That's the one that's dated 4-1-82.
There's objection?
We're going to the motion, I think, should be that you report the bill out. You can recommend that, we can recommend one of them, but actually you're passing the Senate bill out, right?
The motion he made is passing out the House Committee Substitute for Senate Bill number 167, State Affairs.
Right, but really what happens when you get to the floor, I mean, the majority leader can move that that's the one to be accepted, that motion to be defeated. So really this committee is passing out the Senate bill, and we can end up recommending one version or another, which, you know, doesn't make your motion illegal. That bill abolishes APOC, huh?
That's correct.
That's the one that you think the Finance Committee ought to recommend.
That's the motion at this
point. Okay, I object to that motion.
Okay.
I object to this. The committee recommending that version.
Fine. It's your privilege. Is there any further questions? Do you have a call for the question?
Question.
Question has been called for. All in favor of that motion signify by raising your hand. Opposed? Motion carries. We're going to report out 167 with the two fiscal notes out of committee. The last one we're going to take up is Senate Bill 163. Sponsored by Senate Rules Committee at the request of the Legislative Council, rewrites sections of the State Personnel Act. These changes relate to public records, exempt and partially exempt services, amends of and scope of personal rules, personal officers, general prohibits, and hearings and appeals upon dismissal, demotions, or suspensions. The House Judiciary adopted a CS which makes further changes of these sections. A fiscal note by Department of Administration indicates the cost of the Senate version of the bill in FY83 would be $71,800. These funds would be to contact with the Department of Law for the attorney for 4 months to rewrite the personal rules and make necessary changes to the Personality Act, personal act. Is anybody here from administration to testify on this bill?
I'm Ken Kareen, Director of Personnel for the state. 193 had its beginnings with the Legislative Blue Ribbon Commission that is chaired by Senator Ray. The bill has through various committees, as indicated in the report, that have been amended as it has gone along. Earlier, some of the new provisions that were in the bill, we had objections to, and we felt that
the cost and some of the efforts required in them were going to be prohibitive. The bill has been amended in some manners now that we believe it would be an improvement to the act that we presently have. And we can certainly administer and live under it. Rather than get into specific provisions, I'd
rather make myself available for any questions
that are on it.
I haven't read the bill yet, but over the years we've heard problems about the personnel system, different bureaucrats complaining that they can't hire the people they want to. It takes too long to get somebody on the list into the system. If the director has somebody in mind that he knows can do the job, he has difficulty getting that person into his section and his part of the division.
It does only in one regard, and that is that this bill does make provisions for local hire preferences, which we do not have under our current act.
What do you mean by that? If you got an office in Palmer, you could give preference to somebody who lives in Palmer as opposed to somebody who lives in Anchorage.
The details on that, we'd more envision it in more distant areas which are not tied into the metropolitan areas, that we will rank
for non-professional jobs, that we would rank the residents of that area first.
Only rural areas. Indeed, defined rural as what's not being connected by highway to Anchorage.
Well, as the bill stands now, it enables this to be done, but it would require the personnel board to enact rules to define it and carry it out. In the earlier part of your question, the responsiveness was largely staff and the mechanical processing of applications, and I think in the past 9 months,